council are ready to proceed. Good afternoon to the court. My name is Dan Delaney. I'm here appearing on behalf of the appellant. With me today as well is Joseph Murr, another attorney on our office, and Shannon Heiss, the appellant herself, is in gray suit in the gallery, joined by her father. This appeal revolves around essentially one primary issue, and that is the need or lack thereof for an expert witness to determine a standard of care. And that standard of care arises in two separate contexts. One, the contract claims asserted by Ms. Heiss, and two, the professional negligence claims asserted as well. This case takes place in the context of a motion for summary judgment that was filed by the defendants and which was ultimately granted by the trial court. And before we go much further, I do want to point out a sort of primary difference between our brief and the brief of the defendants. Namely, that if you look at the brief of the defendants, you would be unable to determine, I think, at least readily, that this is a case that took place in the context of Rule 56. And to ignore that it took place in the context of Rule 56, I think, is to ignore that very strict standard that movements under 56 are required to adhere to. And it's a standard I think the court is well familiar with, namely that there are no genuine issues of material fact that should stand in the way of the entry of summary judgment. And a trial court, and this court, I would suggest, when evaluating the propriety of a summary judgment order, has to resolve any doubts about the facts in the favor of the non-movement. And that, we would suggest, simply didn't occur in the context of this case. Said differently, the summary judgment standard isn't one to determine close cases. It's one to determine cases where there just aren't any disputed issues of fact, and the court can enter a ruling as a matter of law, dispensing with the need to go to trial.
What exactly is the disputed issue of fact?
I think, A, the applicability of the standard, whether or not...
Isn't that a matter of law?
I think in this context, the court has to evaluate the circumstances. And when the question here is whether this particular behavior is objectionable. And I would suggest, Judge, that if it's a matter of law, I think the court has to err on the side of the plaintiffs in this case, because it has to interpret the facts in light of that legal question.
Well, what facts do you assert are in dispute?
There is a breach of contract question, namely whether or not there was a specific breach of the contract in this case. I think it's axiomatic that the determination of a breach of contract is a question of fact for the fact finder. With regard to the summary judgment context, I think the court has to answer that contract question. It has to say that there are no issues of fact before it can proceed any further.
Well, I mean, if we were to conclude that a standard of care expert was required, why would we have to determine whether there was a breach of contract?
Because
I agree is obviously a disputed fact issue.
Because there isn't any law that's been cited by the defendants to support the proposition that a breach of contract claim requires, as defendants suggest, an expert to evaluate.
Okay, now, in your opposition brief to the first summary judgment motion, mm-hmm. did you specifically argue to the trial court what you just said to me?
We did not, Your Honor. The original motion was drafted didn't seem to suggest that contract was even at issue. I would concede that it alludes to contract, but it seems to allude to contract after having established an argument, which I don't think the trial court adopted, namely that the contract questions transformed into a negligence claim by operation of law.
Okay, but you did not ask the trial court separately to evaluate your breach of contract claim in the context of this overall argument that a standard of care expert is required from the defense perspective, and from your perspective, these uniform standards obviate the need to have an expert.
I think that's an accurate statement, but what we do say in that response, Judge, is that there isn't a standard of care expert required under any circumstances, irrespective of the claims. What we do say is that because USPAP exists, there isn't a need for a separate expert to opine about those things. there are two circumstances under Colorado law where an expert isn't going to be necessary in the tort context. And those two circumstances are, one, where the behavior is so obvious that no expert really has anything more to say than a layperson about the impropriety of that particular behavior. And two, where there is a legislative enactment or some sort of administrative rule that goes to the topic. Both of those things are implicated in this case. As we argued to the trial court in the motion to reconsider, and as we argued to this court, this behavior, and I think I should define the mobile home question, determining whether or not this particular property up in Adams County was in fact a mobile home is the issue. Whether or not the defendants were negligent in answering that question wrongly is the question. And there really doesn't seem to be any problems in the record with the proposition that this is in fact a mobile home, contrary to the record.
Pardon me, Mr. Delaney.
Of course.
You've struck on something that interests me. In both the appraisals, there is this statement. It has been verified with the county appraiser that due to subject being attached to a permanent foundation, subject classification is a single family residence and no longer modular. Subject was never a mobile home. This suggests to me that it was at one point a modular home. And if that is indeed the case, isn't an expert necessary to help the jury figure out, for the purposes of your issue, the negligence in the appraisal, what the difference is between a modular home and a mobile?
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. And Ms. Heist disclosed such an expert. She hired, retained, we disclosed a report and the expert who was going to opine that this was in fact a mobile home. And I don't want to bore the court with the details on the difference between a mobile and a modular home, but suffice to say that they are different. One is built to HUD standards, one is built to something else, something that has wheels on it and can roll down the road.
Which was this?
This was a mobile home, which is the thing that formerly had wheels attached to it.
It was not a modular home.
Not a modular home. That's correct. And that, I think, is clear in the record if you look at the report of Shanker Tyler, who is the expert that was designated to opine as to those issues.
Counsel, let me ask you this. All right. So we have a misidentification, and you would put an expert on to show that was negligent. But then don't you have to go a step further and show the appraisal difference, what effect that had on the appraisal?
Absolutely.
And don't you need an expert for that?
I don't think you need an expert. I think what you need is an appraisal. And what Ms. Heist was prepared to do was put an appraiser on the stand who was going to, and this is referenced in the complaint, there's no mystery here. She had an appraisal that was predicated upon the true facts, namely that this was a mobile home. And that appraisal differed by $100,000+ from the appraisals that were prepared by the defendants. So the damages question, or the impact question, that springs naturally from whether or not the mobile home question gets answered correctly was addressed as early as the complaint.
Did you list that appraiser as an expert?
We didn't list him as an expert, only as a fact witness. Mostly because what that appraiser needs to do is tell what the value of this property is as a mobile home. That appraiser doesn't need to provide testimony about the nuances of appraisal practice in general. All that appraiser was required to do was demonstrate that there is a difference between the value of a property as a mobile home and the value of a property as a stick-built structure, which is what the defendants opined that it was without equivocation.
Now, how can you do that without being listed as an expert?
I think a fact witness can testify. They're not cited in the briefs, but I do recall cases to address the court's question directly that allow a layperson, a homeowner, for example, to opine as to the value of their property. Certainly an appraiser can be a fact witness and say, I prepared this appraisal. I'm a qualified licensed appraiser here in the state of Colorado. I'm not telling you what other appraisers do. I'm telling you what I did. And what I did was appraise this property as a mobile home.
But isn't that above and beyond what the ordinary juror or layperson would be able to do? And isn't that why an expert would be needed in that situation?
In the absence of that appraiser, to stand up and say, here's an appraisal that I did in the ordinary course of my business that looks at this property as a mobile home. In the absence of someone opining on the stand about that, I would agree with you. The jury would not be equipped to know what the difference between the value of a property as a mobile home is and the value of the property as a stick-built structure, which is why we had a fact witness, an appraiser, who was going to have an appraisal report that had been prepared at the time of the complaint. Again, it's referenced in the complaint, who was going to opine about the value, the difference in value between these two properties.
Counsel,
of course.
I see you're running out of time, and I want to get to another area, if I may.
Please.
To your contract claims. Mm-hmm. What's your position on what's the contract in this case?
The contract in this case, I think, is the agreement between the parties to A, prepare an accurate valuation of the property, and B, as is referenced in the record by the specific deposition transcripts, answer the mobile home question. That is a specific question that was asked. That was the purpose of the appraisals.
Those transcripts, however, were not included in your original summary judgment opposition.
They were not, Judge. They were included in the context of the motion to reconsider, again, because the way that motion is written, it didn't necessarily seem as though the contract claims were at issue unless you buy the proposition that they morphed into tort claims by operation of law. We didn't buy that proposition. We indicated that no matter what, there didn't need to be an expert. That raises the contract question that Judge Bernard brought up, raises an interesting question, at least in the context of the 56 motion. Whether or not there was a breach of contract is a question of fact. We say there was a breach of contract. Our opponents, of course, say there was not. That should end the analysis right there on the contract claims. There shouldn't be any more conversation or any more thought on the part of the trial judge about which party is right in the context of Rule 56. That is an issue of fact, and it's inappropriate to enter summary judgment when an issue of fact like that exists.
As long as what the contract is properly before the court, don't you think that the court needs to know what the contract is in order to make that decision?
I think that's a fair statement, but what I would suggest is that the complaint sets forth what the agreement is. The complaint alleges the existence of a contract, and it alleges the breach as well. To the extent that our opponents disagree with us, we have an issue of fact about breach. That and that alone should be enough to thwart the entry of summary judgment under the circumstances. A few words about the order that the court entered. The word contract never appears in that order. It's just not there. There's also no adoption of this theory about the transformation of contract claims into tort claims. I think in the absence of such language, the court's free to overturn that ruling and should do so under these circumstances. I'm going to reserve, if I could, the 2 minutes that I have left for rebuttal. Thank the court.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Byrne, attorney registration number 24494, representing the defendant appellees in this case. Let us begin with the standard for Rule 56 motions. A non-movement has the burden of persuasion at trial, in this case where the plaintiff has the burden of persuasion. The movement for summary judgment need only point to an absence of evidence for the plaintiff to prove her case. That's what the summary judgment motion in this case did. Defendant said, you need expert testimony to prove your claims, regardless of how you have styled them, whether it's negligence, breach of contract, or negligent misrepresentation. You need expert testimony. Now, the assertion that our motion somehow hid the issue that we were dealing with all of the claims is belied by reviewing pages 1 and 2 of that motion, where we set forth, it's 2 and 3, where we state that plaintiff has 4 claims for relief, but the gravamen of each is negligent misrepresentation. We then describe each of the 4 claims. First claim for relief, professional negligence. 4th is negligent misrepresentation. And the 2nd and 3rd claims for relief take a contract approach. We then say that in any event, regardless of the way that it's styled, the duty of care alleged is the same duty, no matter the legal theory, and that is the duty to exercise reasonable care in providing information to others. That's how you would prove a breach of contract in this case, by proving a failure to perform the contract. How would you do that? We don't know whether the contract has a specific provision on that. We don't think so. One's not been shown to us. And so tort law provides the duty of care, which is a duty of reasonable care under the circumstances.
We have Colorado cases that recognize in extreme circumstances a claim can go forward against a professional without a standard of care expert. You know, the doctor that cuts off the wrong leg.
Correct.
Given that this is a 56 posture, how can we say that the dereliction of which the defendants are accused, and obviously I don't prejudge that, how can we say as a matter of law that that isn't like the doctor cutting off the wrong leg, as opposed to saying it is, you know, the magnitude of what they did is obviously disputed in the record, and therefore we can't put this case in the wrong leg category or in the category of the vast majority of other professional negligence cases where you have to say, have a standard of care expert.
Right. Well, this is a matter of discretion for the trial court to decide whether this is an issue that is within the ken of ordinary jurors, I believe is the language. And that is as to both the standard of care and the breach of that standard of care.
All right, well, that's where I get confused, and I would appreciate your help. We don't review summary judgments for abuse of discretion.
Correct.
We review them de novo, resolving all doubt in favor of the plaintiff. So help me understand how that general standard reconciles with your statement that this is a matter of trial court discretion.
Okay. So the issue raised on summary judgment is expert testimony is necessary to prove your claims, and you don't have any.
Okay. And then you don't have it. It's undisputed. But whether you need it seems to me to require fact weighing as to what the defendants did or should have done.
Well, I mean, the decision whether it's required is clearly one within the trial court's discretion. The case law on that is set forth in the briefs and pretty well established. So whether that ruling itself is an abuse of discretion is the ultimate issue before this court, because it necessarily follows if the trial court did not abuse its discretion in requiring expert testimony on that issue, then the absence of expert testimony as to each claim which requires it would be unsupported at the summary judgment stage. And this is after, you know, plaintiffs have had plenty of opportunity to present, to endorse their experts. They endorsed one. There is no report in the record. The reference to the report of Mr. Tyler or Thuler, I'm not sure how you say his name, is improper because that evidence was not before the trial court. There was no evidence presented on the motion for summary judgment. This is a risk that the plaintiffs decided to take for whatever reason.
Well, let me come back to my question, though. Let's assume that the judge denies the summary judgment motion, lets the case go, and then at some point during the trial, you raise the absence of an expert testimony. I mean, I could see at that juncture it would be abuse of discretion and we'd review it differently. But it seems to me by choosing to raise this as a summary judgment, you run the risk of not having the benefit of an abuse of discretion standard as opposed to the traditional summary judgment standard. In other words, can we say as a matter of law, resolving all the nuances of what your clients did or should have done or shouldn't have done in the plaintiff's favor, as a matter of law, a standard of care expert was required?
I don't understand why the standard of review would be different in regardless of the context in which the issue was brought up, whether it was at trial or at the summary judgment stage. I mean, the point of summary judgment is to spare the use of the court's resources and as well as the party's resources when the plaintiff can't prove their case. And the plaintiff had all the evidence that the plaintiff could have for the trial by that time. So if it's an abuse of discretion at the trial level, or at the trial court stage, excuse me, then why is it not, it's not my job to ask you questions, but why is it not appropriate to have the same standard and spare the time and expense of trial?
Because if you raised it during trial, we'd have a fully developed trial record. We wouldn't be asking these questions like, you know, what was the contract? If you raise it at summary judgment, I suggest, you know, certainly don't have to agree that you take that risk, that it's a different standard of review.
But if you can't prove the standard of care, You can't prove a breach in any event.
Well,
whether there's a question of fact as to whether there was a breach is irrelevant if you can't prove the standard of care first.
Well, unless the breach is so egregious that the standard of care is something within the province of the average juror.
Right. And here, plaintiff's response to that was the reference to the USPAP. And let's turn to that for a minute, if you don't mind.
Please, go ahead.
It says that we introduced standard 1.1 as an exhibit to our reply in the summary judgment motion because the response to the motion for summary judgment was the first time that I think we'd heard about the USPAP. So the Uniform Standards for Professional Appraisal Practice state that an appraiser should not render appraisal services in a careless or negligent manner and must not commit a substantial error of omission or commission that significantly affects an appraisal. Now, how these standards would inform a jury, would give them, or anyone, an idea of how to evaluate whether the appraisers in this case, whether their conduct was reasonable, it's a tautology. You know, you should not be negligent, you should not be wrong, is not a standard by which you can evaluate the appraiser's conduct.
What about the portion of the USPAP that says the appraiser must familiarize himself or herself with those features of the property that are particularly material to its value?
How does that apply with respect to mobile homes, modular homes, HUD homes? I've heard of all these terms. That still doesn't provide us a standard of care. And it doesn't say whether she breached the standard of care, whether each of the appraiser defendants breached the standard of care. Plaintiff took the risk of presenting no expert testimony by affidavit or otherwise in this case, despite the fact that defendants were clearly calling them out on the expert testimony issue. The trial court's decision or ruling that the USPAP did not provide specific guidelines for the juries to apply is one that was within its discretion and must be affirmed. There is no basis to find that was manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. And I've already addressed the issue of whether the contract claims were clearly set forth in the motion for summary judgment. And again, bringing that up only in the motion to reconsider is not a proper procedural posture. That argument should have been made in the response for summary judgment, if at all.
Could you respond to your counterpart's argument earlier that he needed an expert only to establish the industry standard of care with regard to whether it was modular or mobile, but once his expert put that in, then he was safe calling an appraiser to put on the damages aspect of his case?
So,
and that the appraiser need not be certified as an expert.
So let's assume that they presented that evidence at the summary judgment stage, which they did not, but that an expert would opine at some other time that the mobile home, that the structure was a mobile home, and that the appraisers are the defendant appraisers were wrong. Okay, that evidence is not in the record. May I just say as an aside, that is not undisputed fact. That was never determined in this case. But even if the appraisers were wrong, that doesn't mean that they did not exercise reasonable care, and did not mean that they breached the standard of reasonable care. There's a case in my brief, it's an attorney malpractice case that says just being wrong does not mean you were negligent. And so.
But if there was a mistake as opposed to an honest error of judgment, would that be negligence?
If it was a breach of the standard of care, the applicable standard of care, and it caused the plaintiff's damages, if it met all the elements of a negligence claim, then it would be negligence. But merely saying that they are wrong doesn't get you there. It's whether, what is the standard of care, and did the conduct here breach that standard of care? It's a remarkably simple case. You know, to me, the most interesting question is you know, summary judgment context versus the trial court context, and the abuse of discretion standard versus a judgment or de novo review. But in any event, there is, I think, no authority for the proposition that raising the absence of evidence, absence of expert testimony, in a summary judgment motion somehow changes the standard to which, you know, a trial court is entitled, and that is to exercise its discretion.
Ms. Byrne, pardon me for interrupting. Sure. I want to make sure I properly understood something that you said before. You said that there was no evidence before the court about the fact that there was an expert who would say that this was a mobile home.
That is correct.
Well, what do you make then of the expert disclosure that Ms. Heiss's counsel filed that identified Mr. Thylor, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, as an expert, and then saying Mr. Thylor will testify regarding his expert opinion that the property in question address is a mobile or HUD home. That was in the record, and that was before you filed the motion for summary judgment.
Right, it was about a week. I have two responses. One, the expert disclosure is a statement of counsel and does not itself constitute evidence. There's no expert report attached, not in my copy of the record and not according to Lexis. So an expert disclosure is meaningless from an evidentiary perspective. Second of all, it's not attached to the motion for summary judgment. Even if it were evidence, they didn't present it as evidence in the summary judgment. And so, despite the fact that it doesn't address the issue, which is the standard of care and whether the defendants breached it, it's not evidence and they didn't present it as such. If there are no other questions, we would ask that this court affirm the trial court's judgment dismissing all of the plaintiff's claims for failure to present necessary expert testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to address a couple of points. One, I think that there is a distinction between making this determination about the expert at the Rule 56 level and after there is a full record and after the court has had the benefit of that full record. To argue otherwise is to ignore the 56 standard. There's a question within a question here. In the context of Rule 56, was the court's decision an abuse of discretion? I think the court can answer that question differently at the end of a trial and in the context of Rule 56. Said differently, all abuses of discretion are not created equal necessarily. I think in the context of Rule 56, one decision may be an abuse of discretion that is not an abuse of discretion at the end of trial. As far as what USPAP says, there are a number of citations made in the briefs to specific sections of the USPAP, identifying relevant characteristics, not making any material errors. It would be difficult to imagine a codified standard, one adopted by a legislature or an administrative body, that would be specific enough to satisfy these defendants as they've set forth their arguments in this case. It is impossible for a legislature, or virtually impossible for a legislature, to contemplate and codify every conceivable course of action, every conceivable act by an appraiser, for example. Instead, what the Colorado Board of Appraisers did was adopt a national standard, calling it the standard of care that all appraisers in the state of Colorado will be evaluated by. They adopted that, as is their right granted them by the legislature, and that adoption is the USPAP. It seems to render superfluous the effort of the Board of Appraisers and the Colorado legislature in enabling the Board of Appraisers to adopt a standard of care, only to say that it's irrelevant. It's not specific enough. You must have an individual sitting on the stand opining about the nuances of appraisal practice. This is a binary question that these defendants were asked.
Is this a standard of, is USPAP a standard of care or merely a professional regulation device giving notice to the members of the profession what their standards are for disciplinary purposes?
I would invite the court to read the specific language in the Colorado regulation that's cited in the brief. That specific language leaves no doubt in my mind that what they have established is a standard of care. I thank the court for its time.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will.